Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Finding the right partner can feel impossible. But not as impossible as finding the perfect parking space in Manhattan. Andy Raskin describes the search for both in his essay, The Hunter-Gatherer Parking Division. It's read by Jason Alexander of Seinfeld fame. He was one of our first and favorite readers for Modern Love, so we asked him to come back and record another essay for us. Here's Jason.
For my third date with Tracy, I'm taking her to the Sumhae Rice Shop in Manhattan. Every Long Island family has a favorite restaurant in Chinatown, and ours is the Sumhae Rice Shop. "You're gonna love this place," I tell her. "When I was a kid, I used to order pork chow mai fun and smear it on the plate with ketchup." Tracy beams at me from the passenger seat. She clearly likes that I'm already sharing family stuff. I wait for the pedestrians to clear before turning off canal onto Mott. At Bayard, I take a left. "There's the restaurant," I say. "You want to get out and I'll go park?"
"Nah," says Tracy. "I'll help you find a spot."
Okay. I drive to the end of Bayard, but there are no spots. At Bowery, I swing a right, then at Pell, another right. There's what looks like a spot, but when we get closer, I notice a two-pronged fire hydrant protruding from a brick wall. Nothing on Pell. I try to reassure Tracy. "We'll find one." "I'm not worried," she says. "I have really good parking karma." I hate that expression. To me, such an attitude belittles the keen sensibility about parking that has been refined and obsessed over and passed down through the male line of my family for generations. I inherited it from my father, one of the all-time great Chinatown parkers. For Richard Raskin, a parking space was not some gift from the gods, not in any way dependent on personal good luck. Rather, it was the direct result of hard work, carefully honed skills, and yes, raw talent. My dad didn't look for parking spaces. He hunted them down. The ability to find one was, to him, the measure of a man. Sons in many cultures learn how to behave as men by observing their fathers, often in rituals that may seem odd to outsiders. There's a tribe in New Guinea, for instance, where the fathers gather together and masturbate into a river while their adolescent male offspring watch. In a similar way, I learned from the backseat of my father's 1977 Chevrolet Caprice Classic that Raskin men find good parking. Quickly. As we approach Elizabeth Street, Tracy is telling me about how her sister used to live in Little Italy. I'm having a hard time listening to her, though, given the weight of the decision now facing me. Circle around the Bayard, Bowery, Pell, Mott, Worth, Mulberry loop again, or chance it near the police station. I make a left, and sure enough, Elizabeth Street is police cars triple parked all the way up the block. I lean my arm on the window and tap rhythmically on the steering wheel, trying to draw attention from the fact that I am soon sheepishly heading back to Bayard. Tracy is still talking, and I pretend to follow along. Luckily, she doesn't seem to have grasped the truth, which is that I'm not half the Chinatown parker my father was. When my father didn't see a spot, he made a spot. And his car was easily several inches longer than my Toyota Celica. Good thing Tracy never saw his parking. I'll never forget it. First he would get quiet. Then his eyes would squint as he scanned each block for the telltale signs of a future space. A taillight glowing red, a car door flying open, the sound of an engine turning over. Sometimes my sister or I would say, "There's a spot!" But my father wouldn't even slow down. He had long since scoped out that it was a no-go because of a driveway or a hydrant. Tension in the car would build. We thought we might never find a spot. Then, suddenly, my father would flick on his blinker and start backing into a space so tiny the rest of us never saw it. We were always skeptical at first. "This isn't a spot," my mother would say, shaking her head. "It's a spot," he would assure her. He would always find some way to wedge the car in. Sometimes he'd go at it for 10 minutes. I remember the look of pride on his face when he was done, and I knew he had accomplished something very important. My mother, post-parking, suddenly appeared calmer, as if thinking, "I am very glad I married this man." When Tracy and I get back to where Pell meets Mott, I spy an old Chinese woman laden with shopping bags who's breaking formation with the crowd on the sidewalk. She is reaching for her keys. I run the stop sign and hover behind her. She gets into her car and I wait for her to pull out, but she just sits there. She doesn't even start the engine. I pull up to her window, point over my shoulder with my thumb and raise my eyebrows. The universal gesture for "you getting out?" But she just stares at me. I do the gesture again, and this time she does the wave-off head shake. "Jeez," I say. I continue along Mott. Tracy looks concerned. I suspect she is starting to put it all together. She is thinking, if this guy can't find a spot now, how will he provide for me if we take things further? What if we have kids? What if we take them to Chinatown? They'll probably starve to death while this bozo circles around. I'm already halfway to Worth Street when in my rearview mirror, I see that old lady pulling out of her spot. "Damn!" I scream. "The hag was playing me!" Tracy tries to calm me down. "Andy, maybe we should just put it in a lot."
"Oh, my God!
A lot? Why doesn't she just drag me out of the car and castrate me?" "Listen, my father never paid for spots. Never. On the rare occasion when it didn't look as if he was going to find a spot within a reasonable amount of time, he would drop off my mother, my sister, and me at the Sum Hay Rice Shop, and he would go park by himself. Of course, a few minutes later, when he joined us at the restaurant, he would walk through the door with an unmistakable swagger." "You found a spot," my mother would say. He'd curl his upper lip and give her a quick nod, the kind of nod given by underbosses on The Sopranos to tell Tony that they have just killed someone. It was the nod that says, "It's taken care of." I'm just going to circle around a couple more times," I say to Tracy, trying to sound calm. Years ago, while visiting my paternal grandfather at his retirement community in Florida, I recorded him telling me his life stories. He related tales of how he invented a new way to cool ice cream trucks and how his father came to America after deserting the Russian army. But he really came to life as he was telling me about the parking spot he found while on a date with my grandmother circa 1930. "I borrowed my mother's 1921 Ford coupe," he said. "And one time I took Sylvia into Manhattan, and I parked that Ford coupe on 34th Street. In case I didn't understand the significance of that location, he added, "Right next to Macy's."
"If it's the money," Tracy says to me now, "we can split it."
I cannot believe she thinks this is about money. I have a good job. I can afford to put it in a lot, believe me. But the idea of paying someone to park my car, I mean, what kind of loser pays for parking in Chinatown? Do I look that pathetic? I'm on Pell again, but now the idea of paying for parking is out there, and it spreads through me like a cancer. I'm considering it, and what it will mean for me, for my future with Tracy. Then, I see the spot with the hidden fire hydrant again, and I realize there may be enough space. I pull in. The front of my car is a few feet from the hydrant. I decide it's an acceptable risk.
You can't park here, Tracy says. You're too close to the hydrant.
Don't worry about it, I say. In Chinatown, if you can't find a spot, you make a spot. Tracy rolls her eyes, but I withdraw the key from the ignition. We get out of the car, and Tracy slams her door shut.
You would rather park here and possibly get in the way of a fire truck rescuing someone than put it in a lot?
Yeah.
Tracy looks into the distance. You are so self-centered.
I'm starting to get the feeling that I will never meet her sister who lived in Little Italy. Maybe Tracy is right. Maybe I am a little too close to the hydrant. My father surely would have found a better parking spot. Even my grandfather would have put me to shame parallel parking his borrowed 1921 Ford Coupe in bustling pre-war Midtown. But in one respect, Tracy has it all wrong. I am so the opposite of self-centered. The only thing I have been centering on is how to impress her and take care of her. Which is to say, I've been trying to be a man. And in my tribe, when it comes to parking, a man takes charge. A man finds spots.
That's Jason Alexander reading Andy Raskin's essay, The Hunter-Gatherer, Parking Division. We'll catch up with Andy and Jason after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Andy says that to the best of his memory, he did not get a ticket the day that he parked a little too close to the fire hydrant. And after his piece came out, he heard from others who understood the struggle to find good parking.
And many people told me that they also related to this idea that other cities or even other parts of Manhattan were kind of like the minor leagues. And then when you got to Chinatown, it was like breaking into the big leagues. And certain blocks within Chinatown, maybe like the All-Star game.
Even though Andy successfully found a spot on that date with Tracy, their relationship didn't last. But a few months after his modern love essay was published, he went on a date with a woman named Emily.
On this date, we went to a sushi restaurant, and I got a spot right in front of the restaurant. And she looks at me and she goes, "Wow, this is a really hot spot. This spot is really turning me on." And I knew she was joking. You know, I knew she was kidding that she'd read the piece, but it didn't matter. Like, I still felt like, yes. And I felt, you know, like a man.
About 3 years later, Andy and Emily got married.
And even today, I still feel the pressure all the time whenever we go out. And not just when it's the two of us, when it's with other people or we have a son with our son. And she'll still bring it up. She'll still be like, wow, this is a great spot. And I still feel great about it.
Andy hasn't thought much about what it'll be like when his 6-year-old son is old enough to drive. But he says he does not want to pass on his obsession with parking.
You know, I think the parking kind of represents a lot of things that I, or maybe other people too, put pressure on ourselves to somehow measure up against some ideal that we have from parents, some way that we're supposed to be. In a way, the piece I think is about how that conversation in your head can cut you off from other people who you might, you know, want to get close to. And realizing that was a big step for me.
Andy Raskin. He's a messaging strategist in the tech industry where he helps CEOs tell the stories of their companies. And just so you know he's not exaggerating, Andy gave us that actual recording of his grandfather bragging about his parking skills.
One time I remember taking Sylvia to Macy's and parking that 1921 Ford on 34th Street right next to Macy's.
We've got more in a minute.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Here's Jason Alexander.
It's so funny. That character that Raskin's talking about is so much like my dad, my uncles. It's that New York, New Jersey, second generation Jewish, Italian, Irish, Scottish immigrant, that really parking your car in Manhattan was a badge of honor. And when I was a kid, I saw my father lift my mother's 1957 Dodge Dart one end at a time over a 4-foot snowbank. So I knew my father was sort of preternaturally strong. And he had gotten his car into one of these spots where there was really just a few atoms of air on either side of the fenders. And I said, "Dad, did you like just park it outside that spot and push it sideways and fit it in like a block into a space?" I'm telling you, the whole thing was almost biographical. And the minute I heard it, I went, "I know these guys and I can do their story."
Thank you again to Jason Alexander for so brilliantly reading this week's piece. And here's Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times.
He's sort of trapped in a sense of manhood, but as his essay reveals, he's completely aware of it. That doesn't save him from it, though. In the end, he's still going to feel a total charge and feel macho if he can find a spot. and he's going to feel like he's an embarrassment if he can't.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, Caitlin O'Keefe, John Perotti, and Amory Sievertson. Additional sound design by Paul Vikas. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.